I remember I say a lot.
So me too, don't worry.
I'm going to be really conscious not to
say. I giggle a lot and I don't know why. It's just, yeah, I just do it. I say.
Yeah, me too. Wait, let's have a competition. Yeah. Let's see who can do the most amount of ums.
Yeah. Welcome to Nourished by Spinnies, the podcast which promises to inspire you to eat well and live well. I'm Tiffany Eslick.
And I'm Devina Devecha. This is a space where we hope to nourish your heart and soul. On this show, we chat with leading players in the food community, from farmers to foodies, as well as health and well-being experts. It's all about engaging conversations and fresh ideas.
And we're continuing our two-part mini-series that we're calling The Artist and The Scientist.
So to recap, on our last episode, Tiff, you spoke to the artist, Chef Grégoire Berger, on the way he conceptualizes his menu.
I don't want to frame myself to something that is too defined.
Yeah.
Art, and I believe what we do is art. It's a wider thing, right?
You'll find that episode in your podcast players right before this one, so definitely give it a listen if you haven't already.
And from that captivating conversation, we're moving to the scientist and the incredible precision of the menu at One Michelin Star Dinner by Heston Blumenthal at Atlantis The Royal with head chef Tom Allen.
When a dish goes on, it gets the first stage is developing, creating all the recipes and you know, creating the recipe packs. They then get sent to us, and there's probably about 20 things that it goes through. You know, we need to source the ingredients, we need to go through all the health and safety aspect. If there's any high-risk items, we send that off to a lab to get tested, even put in the right button on the micro system. So the first time we press the button on the micro system, the check prints out and it's the correct, you know, word. So it's very detailed.
Yeah.
And then we'll usually probably start by serving, you know, 6 or 10 portions a night, just to get the probably for the first 5 nights, just to get the flow right.
Okay.
Know, introducing a new dish into the kitchen. Logistical hurdles to overcome and serving, and you know, cutlery and plateware and china, that's all thought out beforehand.
When I first heard that, it sounded so intense. And then perhaps not so much when you realize the person behind this is Chef Heston Blumenthal. This is the man behind the iconic 3 Michelin star fat duck, the 2 Michelin star dinner by Heston in London, and now 1 Michelin star dinner by Heston right here in Dubai. Tiff, have you been to one of his restaurants?
So I have been to dinner in London twice.
Okay.
I've always wanted to go to the Fat Duck, but I've never managed to get there. And I've dined at Dinner by Heston in Dubai last year. They were running the Pompeii menu at the time, and it was absolutely fabulous. I'll actually talk to Chef Tom about that menu a little later in the episode as well.
I actually haven't been to any of his restaurants just yet, but of course, they are all definitely on my list.
They have to be. And obviously what they do is incredibly creative, but it's backed by a rigorous, almost scientific process where everything is tested over and over and everything is so precise, from the logistics to even the way ingredients are sourced. Speaking of which, do you have a favorite ingredient that you like to cook with?
Well, I like to bake a lot. So for me, I need to have, you know, a recipe in front of me, and I'm happy with being told how much to measure and what to do. So I enjoy the science part of it. But a must have in my baking cupboard is definitely dark chocolate. I'm the kind of person where if a recipe doesn't say dark chocolate, I just assume it's going to be dark and I throw that in anyway. But yeah, how about you, Tiff?
I think I'm a bit of a fickle chef because, you know, I have a new favorite every week.
Okay.
I mean, I think I've loved shopping for ingredients ever since I was a child and discovering new products. I'm currently obsessed with Aleppo pepper. Yeah. It's not a new ingredient, but it's something that I really, really like. I also really enjoy smoking things, so like hot smoking salmon.
Yeah.
So maybe hot smoke is the ingredient more than the salmon. But then I also like cacao and lovage, which is actually one of Chef Tom's 3 favorite ingredients as well.
That's interesting. What are the other two?
Well, that's exactly what I asked him.
I absolutely love shiitake mushrooms. I think they're very versatile. Very versatile. I think they're full of flavor, like lots of umami flavor. So we use them a lot for kind of depth of flavor. We smoke them and char them in the jasper and then infuse them with like a dashi soy with a little bit of bonito just to get a depth of flavor. But
oh my God,
so I love shiitake mushrooms. So yeah. Lovage, I think, is a beautiful herb. You can use it in savory or sweet. We have a dessert with lovage on as well. And then I love bergamot. So in bergamot season, we have we add bergamot into our curing of our salmon, our fish, and also in a dressing as well. It's just really, really floral and really also really nice in the gin and tonic.
Yes. interesting that you mentioned Natura, actually. I love following them on Instagram. Did you see what they did for Valentine's Day with the radicchio?
I didn't know.
And they just like these amazing installations and like sent out these boxes to everyone with radicchio instead of roses. And I just think what they're doing is super creative.
Yeah, and they've grown and they've, I think they went into Ocado in the UK.
Yeah.
I remember during lockdown they were supplying Ocado and I think they were one of the companies that thrived during lockdown with home deliveries in the UK. But they managed to, I think they had an incredible team of people and they managed to grow, but still be true to themselves and just be about the quality and some of the ingredients they were getting. And Delica pumpkin.
Phenomenal.
I remember the farmer from Northern Italy during the kind of spring, summer months, he'd grow melon.
Yeah.
And then going into kind of later summer, into autumn, he'd have pumpkins.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
This one pumpkin, which you have other companies and other growers, they grow the same variety. But what this farmer was doing, he was obviously tending to each pumpkin individually, and he would farm them. He would pick them and then put them into a warehouse, a climate-controlled warehouse. And he would wait until... That the pumpkin would lose 30% of its volume of moisture.
Yeah.
And when it hit, he would literally weigh each one and they'd put like a little wax cap on the top of the stalk, and that's where the moisture is kind of passed through. So by putting the wax cap on, you see it a lot with pears and apples.
Yeah, you do.
So it's to stop the ripening process.
Oh, okay.
And then literally, I'd heard pumpkin, mentioned a lot in my career, kind of coming through the years. And I remember tasting the Delica pumpkin.
Yeah.
I remember it just being next level, and I'd never tasted anything like it. We had a really beautiful quail dish on in dinner London with the Delica pumpkin. So if you're ever in London,
often
in the tour, and it's that time of year, grab a Delica pumpkin and just slowly roast it. It's incredible. I miss the Delica pumpkins from the tour.
You talk so passionately about like ingredients. Just having spoken to you now for like 10 minutes. What are your fondest memories? Like, have you always been passionate about food and ingredients like since you were a kid? Like what are your memories about that?
So it comes from mum and dad. So my dad always grew lots of vegetables and fruit in the garden. And as a child, I didn't really appreciate it. I'd go out and help and I'd kind of stamp on a few things and probably frustrate him and do the fun bit, putting the seeds in and obviously watering and then you have to be patient and wait for it to grow. And mum always cooked. She was always really great at home cooking. So we obviously during the summer and kind of autumn, we used to always harvest the vegetables and the fruit and we'd be always part of cooking family meals. And I think when you grow and you have that appreciation as well, and it's something that I think is done full circle. I remember dad always being in the garden and kind of tatting in the garden. And then, he'd come in at certain times of year with a lot of runner beans or a lot of blackberries and, you get to taste the fruit and the vegetable at the peak of season as well, which I think you taste what they should taste like, and obviously we're in a very consumer-led world, mass-produced world and it has to be, to keep up with the population. So sometimes you taste a lot of fruit and vegetables and meat as well, proteins, fish. You taste a lot of bad examples of what things should not taste like. So when you taste something in season and it's been part of your childhood and I do the same, where we can with my daughters.
Oh, cool.
And I think it's good just to show them, show children where food comes from.
Absolutely. And understand really the effort that's involved.
Absolutely. It's an investment, just talking about the pumpkin we're talking about, not only do they grow them, but they then age them and hit a certain weight. We obviously at dinner, we always look for the best quality ingredients and we try not to do too crazy things with them. We have our detailed methodology and our technique that we've learned from, the Fat Duck and from Heston from the last 25, 30 years almost. And we just try and stay true to what the ingredient is and just treat it with respect. When we're cooking a piece of beef in the restaurant, it's a 2-year-old investment, from the farming, the aging process as well. So it's really important for us to treat it with respect and hopefully not overcook it pair it with some tasty ingredients and some wines or non-alcoholic pairings as well and have the story of where that came from. We're not forceful with it in our service in the restaurant, but if a guest asks you know, where the chicken came from or where that ingredient came from. Like I say, if people don't want to know, then that's fine. We do a lot of the background, you know, sourcing, the testing to find what we feel is the best, whether it's a piece of fish or chicken or duck.
Yeah.
Or, you know, vegetable, herb, fruit to you know, represent what we want it to represent on the dish. So it's just to have that information and that backstory.
And working with ingredients like that, and you know, obviously you've learned a lot from Heston, and you've grown over the years, and you're teaching many, many people. What would you say is like the biggest thing that you've learned having worked with Heston?
You know, Heston is an amazing, amazing person. And I have a very personal and professional relationship with him. And so much of what I do in my life in the kitchen and what I do in my life out of the kitchen, I think has started by, you know, you're working at the Fat Duck, you're working at the three Michelin star level. It's really hard to explain. It's almost like a cult. And everyone is there for the reasons to, you know, to learn and to be passionate and enthusiastic together, and just to be part of this amazing adventure to create an amazing dining experience, to work with the best ingredients and some of the best chefs and, you know, service people in the world. You get this, it sounds really cliche, but it's like a little family, like a work family. And we laugh a lot and we have a good time and we have lots of banter. We're serious when we need to be. And, but it's just, you know, we try to create a very, very relaxed, but disciplined work environment. So relaxed in the same way that we're not a hierarchical kitchen or restaurant. We have great cohesiveness between the kitchen and the service team. You know, John, the general manager, he's one of my best friends. We came on this journey together to Dubai. We worked in London with one another for 8.5 years, and we've been 2.5 years in Dubai. And you know, we disagree, but you know, it's good to disagree.
Absolutely.
In a professional and a constructive way, and we push each other and we back each other up, and that filters through into the team. You know, we sit in our 1 o'clock operations meetings every day and we go through all the bookings, and we just end up belly laughing, and what they must see on the cameras, think what are those guys doing. But and I think it's so important to start the day, you know, on a good note.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, have that throughout the team, and for people to challenge each other. I want the chefs, I want everyone to challenge me, just like I challenge, you know, them respectfully. We never stay still. We're always looking for, you know, that next new dish or that next thing or that next new way of doing things, and obviously adapting for Dubai as well. You know, London is a very different city to Dubai. Dinner London is a very different restaurant, you know, to dinner Dubai. It's very similar, but it's very different as well. It has a very different feel. We have music playing in this in Dubai, which we never did in London.
I remember that actually from being at dinner in London.
There was always music kind of coming from the bar, which was connected.
So Ashley said that, because I interviewed Ashley years ago, and and he said the same thing. Like, it was very focused and like...
And it was, and I think that's good, but I think in Dubai, it's a very different vibe. I think, you know, the guests expect there to be the atmosphere of music, and, you know, it's very moody and atmospheric. Yeah. It's more a nighttime restaurant for Dubai. Having said that, we've just launched Sunday lunch, so we have to put the blinds down because you see that now that the light is very bright and we have incredible... view. I mean, it's a pretty amazing office window. You're looking at the marina
and
skyline.
Daytime and night. I mean, at night,
and
it's
comes
mesmerizing.
To life at night. Yeah, it's incredible. And to be in a land, you have the fountain going off every half hour. And
how do you keep your guys, like yourselves, motivated with this creativity? Because, I mean, what you're putting out is super creative, you know, and so innovative. And I mean, I know you're working with a huge team when you're researching a new dish, or you're looking at, you know, going and delving into the history of something on a new project. Yeah. Are you like reading every single day and watching tons of stuff? And
no, I'm not. Yeah. I should read more. Yeah. To be honest, I really struggle with reading. I'm a real visual learner, and having conversations. And we had a Zoom call yesterday with the creative team from the Fat Duck Group, talking about up and coming menus and activations that we can you know, include in Dubai. Also, we've just engaged with a professor. I think his name is Daniel Newman. He's based in London and he spent a lot of time in Abu Dhabi. So we're looking at doing some Arabic food research incorporate, you know, Bedouin culture, spice route, and local kind of key ingredients and flavors onto the menu so that we can have, you know, that point of difference from London.
Yeah.
So we're literally in the early stages of that. So we work with food historians, curators of museum, and we have an extensive development team in Bray. So we all research, go to the British Library a couple of times a year. We have pretty extensive access into their archives, very, very exclusive and very fortunate that we get to go in, and we have books in our hands from as early as the 13th century up to early 19th century, which is, you know, more recent food history, but it is food history. You know, yesterday technically is history.
Yes.
So we work with you know, a team there, Polly Russell, food historian. We go and we literally take out books from the archives and we delve into them. And a lot of them we have to get translated because they didn't really have a language to write down. It was, you know, didn't read or write. So a lot of the recipes back then were passed down by, you know, mouth and kind of phonetically writing and, you know, Latin. So we have to get them translated. And then we literally take those dishes and ingredients, and then we'll take those dishes back to our and references back to our development kitchen in Bray near the Fat Duck. And we will research and we will map out and we will reimagine and recreate the dishes from the past to bring them back to life. So you know, it's a pretty special thing to be able to do.
Yeah, it's like alchemy, you know, and it's
that's it. Yeah. So and it's lovely. You can bring forgotten dishes and ingredients, and in the research we actually found out that Britain had a far more extensive, you know, food culture than we think they did. You know, so that was what Heston really planned to do with dinner, and to bring old dishes back to life and put Britain on the, you know, the gastronomic map.
When we come back, Chef Tom tells me how he's not much of a planner and prefers to live in the moment, and some of the dishes I tried from the Pompeii menu. That's right after this short break. We wanted to take a minute to tell you about our delicious Spinney's Food olive oil, which comes from the 120-year-old Basso family farms in Italy, which is now a fifth-generation business. Davina, if you remember my masterclass with Matthew Jones of Bread Ahead, this is the olive oil we use to make the focaccia.
I remember that. It was delicious.
Yes, and part of the reason for that is their use of the Arbequino olive grown in Italy. Here's Federico Basso.
The Arbequino olive is usually used in blends because it's very sweet and it has that almond taste, which is very different from the typical strong Italian olive oils that we have. So we use it in blend in order to provide our customers with a product that is as balanced as possible. So it's not too aggressive, but it's also not too plain. We want to find the perfect match in order to satisfy our clients, also in terms of organoleptic features of our products.
Here's a fun fact. Federico's father, Sabino, eats extra virgin olive oil and bread every morning for breakfast, sometimes with a spoonful of sugar.
And didn't you say that he's run many marathons? Clearly, that's the trick.
We source their extra virgin olive oil, a truffle-infused Evu, and a signature Mediterranean blended oil as well. So you should definitely grab a bottle of Spinney's Food olive oil the next time you're in store and tell us what you think. Welcome back. You're listening to Nourished by Spinney's. And let's get right back to our conversation with Chef Tom Allen. Yeah, how long will it take? So let's say you like, right, in 2025, we want to launch.
But we want to Arabic menu. I would imagine, hopefully, I would say within 6 to 8 months, we'll have some dishes on.
So okay.
Obviously, they go through a very rigorous development process, and then we need to. It goes through a whole process of, you know, we need to source the ingredients. We need to go through all the health and safety aspect. If there's any high risk items, we send that off to a lab to get tested.
Yeah.
To make sure that our cooking techniques and methods are safe. Tasting the wines or non-alcoholic pairings. Training the team, allergens.
Yeah.
So we have, when a dish goes on, it gets the first stage is developing, creating all the recipes and you know, creating the recipe packs. They then get sent to us, and there's probably about 20 things that it goes through. Quite lengthy process, but it means that when that dish goes on the menu, even putting the right button on the micro system. So the first time we press the button on the micro system, the check prints out and it's the correct, you know, word. So in a busy service, we're not having to say one thing and then something else. So it's very detailed. And then we'll usually probably start by serving, you know, 6 or 10 portions a night just to get for the first 5 nights, just to get the flow right, you know, introducing a new dish into the kitchen.
Yeah.
It, it, your logistical hurdles to overcome and serving, and you know, cutlery and plateware in China, that's all thought out beforehand. So
actually 6 to 8 months is really not that long if you think of all the research that's going in, but to some people,
and I know you, part of what you do is the development process, so you have an understanding of that, but coming up with new and exciting dishes that you like, the meat fruit, the tipsy cake, it takes a long time.
How do you top such great
dishes?
That's
it. Yeah. And you try to change it for that point of difference, but if you get a dish that's just incredible, I remember that there's so many dishes from my time at the Fat Duck that I look back on, and it's they're almost perfect.
Yeah.
To come away from that, you just got to have the confidence to go, right, this will always be on the menu, or that will come out at a later date and it will always be that dish. But we have dishes at dinner that they haven't changed. We've tried to change them and it doesn't really work, and you're always comparing it to what it was. So
yeah,
we obviously try and we have a bank of dishes that we bring on the menu, and through seasons we've just put lobster and cucumber soup on, which is very fresh. It's delicious. So
that does sound delicious.
You have to come in and have it.
I will.
It's on the menu. It's very green, so very green, fresh.
Yeah,
cucumber soup. So we juice the cucumbers, lots of the peel and the skin to get the lovely green color.
Mm-hmm.
And then we serve it with lots of sorrel.
Okay,
lots of edible herbs, and again, just keeping it very simple, but again, ingredient led. Yeah, the dishes interchange through the year, but we have dishes that always come back and will always remain on the menu as well, like meat fruit, tipsy cake, salamagundi.
Don't ever take
one. No, tipsy. I've eaten so many tipsy cakes in the last 12 years.
Yeah.
And it's, I actually, the last two nights, I've gone into the pastry section and I've eaten two tipsies before I leave, which is not good at that time of
it's
night.
Like emo eat some tipsies.
It's tipsy. Not good, but it's like having a big cuddle. It's like comfort food at its absolute best.
I have to agree.
Yeah.
How many meat fruits have you eaten?
Not so many meat fruits, actually.
Yeah.
I try not to.
Yeah.
Obviously, we taste them to check the quality, but that's one of the dishes that you can eat over and over. And then when you come in the restaurant and you've got a glass or something nice to go with it, and you're with your friends and family, it's a very clever dish, and it really provokes emotion, and it's bit of trompe l'oeil. Things aren't quite as you seem, you know, you think you're eating something that it's not, and it's a nice surprise. But
I mean, I think it's one of those iconic dishes in the world.
Is.
I mean, you know, just from the sheer number of people that have tried to copy it. But
we have inspired lots of people, and that's great.
Inspired is a good way of putting it. I remember when it first came out, you know, and I remember reading about it and then thinking, when I am in London, I am going to try this. And I did,
How many times did you go to dinner in London?
Twice.
Okay.
Yeah. I went once just for fun and once for work.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Did you get to see the Queen's Guards passing by?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was lovely during kind of end of breakfast, going into the beginning of lunch. You see the change of guards. It was, and then obviously Hyde Park.
Yes. Yeah.
Evolving through the seasons as well.
Yeah.
We have a very different view, but just a stunning in a very different way.
Yeah. In a very different way, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Pompeii menu.
Okay.
So is that still running?
It's not.
Oh,
no. So
okay.
We ran that for the month of, I think it was November, the month of November. And I remember, again, we worked with a food historian called Paul, who literally devoted his whole life to Pompeii. I think he was involved in the excavation of the city.
Yeah.
And, you know, discovering all the artifacts and, you know, just, again, so much passion and enthusiasm. So we collaborated with him and his team at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. And I remember Heston calling and saying, right, I want to do something with Pompeii. Like, I remember thinking, what's he talking about?
Yeah.
And then obviously, you know, we went to the museum, we walked around the exhibition and really kind of lived and breathed it, and got to chat with his team and work with the historians there and just delve in more into the ingredients and what was going on in society in Pompeii at the time. Obviously the disaster, which was, you know, devastating, but you know, from that disaster, we were able to, maybe if we didn't, you know, if that volcano hadn't erupted and you know, buried the city, maybe we wouldn't have had so much insight as to how they were living their life, what they were eating, and actually how far in advance they were in at that time.
Yeah.
You know, they had hot water pipes, you know, copper pipes with hot water running through them, which almost 2,000 years ago was, it's quite,
it's
hard to
yeah.
Kind of comprehend.
Yeah.
So yeah, we worked with the team and we took the ideas back and we created the menu, which obviously you came in and had.
I'm sad that it's not on anymore because I would totally come back for it.
The dishes will absolutely come back.
Okay.
You know, maybe as individual dishes, but yeah, lots of depth of flavor.
Absolutely. That butter that you had with the ash bread. Was it squid ink butter?
Squid ink butter with prawn head oil. And a dashi, an umami dashi went into it. And yeah, I remember we did this butter and Heston was like, right, what about taking liquid nitrogen and whisking it up? And I remember thinking, okay, yeah, we'll try that. And I remember we did it. And that's the thing that Heston is just, he's just genius at, you know, obviously inspiring the team, coming in and we may have worked on something and think that we're there and he'll come in and, you know, just maybe go a little bit left or a little bit right and then bring it back in and just put those little clever touches on. So yeah, we took the butter, tempered it and then whisked it with liquid nitrogen and it actually looked like a piece of molten lava rock.
Yeah.
And then we just had he was like, right, what to get the prawn head. He discovered prawn head oil on one of travels to, I think Asia. And we managed to source it in the UK and obviously here as well through one of our suppliers. And the flavor it's like the smell and the flavor of a fresh prawn. And he's like, what about if we put some drops on so it looks like molten lava? And you're like, all right. And we did it and it looked amazing.
Yeah.
And it just added to the depth of flavor as well. And then, yeah, with the bread, the loaves. So obviously life was going on as normal, you know, in the year 79 AD.
As it did
and when the people of Pompeii woke up, they had no idea what was coming their way. First of all, the volcanic pebbles covered the city over a number of hours, and that was what preserved the city. And then once the city was covered in the, you know, the rock debris, then the volcano erupted, and I think Pompeii was a coastal city, and then after the volcano erupted, it was a couple of kilometers inland, which just, you know, gives you the extent of what actually happened.
Yeah.
And they excavated a bakery and within the oven, they found carbonized loaves. So, I mean, it's incredible. They found honey, they found olive oil. And Paul, the historian, he lifted we weren't able to, but he lifted the stopper out of the olive oil bottle and he said it smelled like olive oil, which is, it's incredible. So they found these loaves, and obviously they were carbonized. They had 23, I think, and I think they brought some over. I remember we took on the shape of the loaf, and then we put our little kind of our inspiration. So we put ash in there, and we put kind of some grains from Italy. We tried to use as many ingredients as we could, incredible ingredients from Italy, to keep it authentic and to have that backstory as well.
Yeah. And we served delicious wines. It was unbelievably delicious.
So that bread served warm with the butter is pretty nice. So we worked with the team here to create the loaf, the in-house bakers, and for them, you know, it's something new and, you know, inspiring those the team down there and working with them and adjusting, you know, this and adding that. So yeah, the bread was pretty lovely.
And the smoked mussels were also highly memorable.
Yeah,
one of my favorite dishes.
The lovage and the smoked mussel broth. And again, garum, you know, that was something that we worked with. So garum was a seasoning, anchovy. So we actually used garum that came from the Amalfi Coast. So they take the sardines, fillet them, salt them, and then let them ferment in a chestnut barrel for the summer. And then obviously the garum that we had was the all the juice and the you know, depth of umami flavor from the salt and the anchovies, kind of light fermentation as well. So the Romans would carry around with them a little pouch of seasoning, garum, and that would be how they would take their food and they kind of give it seasoning. So yeah, to take that and to, you know, to use wines from the vineyards from near Pompeii.
No, I thought it was very well put together, the whole menu, all the pairings, but. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. It was fantastic, you know.
That's good.
I just remember just being in this like whirlwind of amazing food.
Cool. And that's, you know, that's what we love doing at the restaurant as well, is serving tasty food that we try to find the best quality ingredients and treat them with respect. And, you know, obviously the methodology that we've learned. And obviously in dinner we have the Josper oven. So a lot of sous vide cooking on charcoal and embers, lots of pickling, smoking, brining, which obviously, you know, we've learned over the years, you know, they didn't have refrigeration. So for them to, you know, get through the year, get through the seasons and preserve food, it was a lot of pickling and smoking. So we've adopted a lot of pickling and smoking on our menu.
Is there like a time or a country or something that you would love to really go into great research about? I don't know. Are you fascinated by, say, Peru? Or is there a specific era that you would love to go and work on?
Wise, it's quite a hard question, actually, to think about.
Yeah, sorry, I just threw that one in.
It's caught me off guard, that one. I don't know. I'm really excited about what we can pull out of the Arabic, you know, to see what we can do and hopefully connect with, you know, a lot of our guests, you know, from this region. So I'm really excited about, you know, obviously finding ingredients and the backstory as well. You know, to be able to, we love storytelling, and again, you know, if our guests want to, you know what was going on in society or know why we've come to serve that dish, we have that authenticity and that storytelling element. You know, edible history, Heston calls it. some people want to come to the restaurant and have that, you know, go down the rabbit hole, as we say, you know, Heston's obsession with Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, I loved it. I love the way that you give those cards out and you're like, do you want all the information? Yeah. Do you want a little? I was like, yes, give me everything. Because you go down that rabbit hole and you just get like sucked into this, all this information and history and inspiration. And, you know, you've got to take part in it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was the way, you know, we implemented. I remember having a chat with Heston in the south of France when I went and stayed with him. And I remember we were in this beautiful little restaurant in his little like hometown of where he lives in Egalia, in Provence, near Provence. And I remember we're in this little restaurant. I said to him, I bet you love coming here because he wasn't getting bothered and, you know, everyone coming up. And, you know, he loves that element of it. And, you know, he's amazing when people come up and acknowledge him. And that's part of what has made him, you know, Heston.
Yeah.
But it just really honest human restaurant and, you know, passing the restaurant, the menu to each other. I'm not great at reading menus and he's not either. So he's like, what do you want? I'm not sure. You order. He's like, no, you order. So we're kind of back and forth, you know, passing the menu to each other. And then him saying, you know, what he loves about coming to restaurants is he loves just to be with the people he's with and immerse himself in the dining experience and not get bothered too much in the nicest possible way. So those cards were a way of us, of you know, sometimes we get people come in on business dinners or they come in and they, you know, with friends and family, or they've traveled here and they've made a point from their trip to book this restaurant, which is amazing. And they want the full, you know, immersive story. Other people just want to be, you know, minimal. Okay, this is your dish and kind of left alone and really unintrusive service. So what those cards do is it just gives you as the diner, just to cut out the awkwardness of, okay, we want the full experience, or we just want to, you know, in our own company. So yeah, it works well. It works well with those cards.
I encourage everyone to tick or put the card that says tell me
and
everything.
Swap the cards around as well to the meal. Make sure the service team are paying attention.
Yeah, exactly. Keep them on their toes.
That's cool.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, I have one more question. Yep. And actually two more questions. Okay. I wanted to ask you, like, when you set out as a chef, what kind of vision did you have for yourself? And I mean, did you ever think that you would be where you are now?
Do you know what? No, I don't. My wife and I, we don't really plan too much.
Yeah.
We just, you know, we go on journeys together with our daughters as well. And we just surround ourselves by good people. And we do something. We love what we do. And we put a lot of effort and emphasis onto, you know, our paths. We make, you know, choices that put us into, you know, we made a choice to come to Dubai, which we're so happy we did, and we're very proud to be here at this time. And I think it's a phenomenal place, and the city is growing, and what they've achieved in Dubai in the last 50 years, 60 years is mind blowing. Yeah. And what's going on within our industry as well, you know, the food and beverage industry, and is really exciting. And you know, the Michelin Gourmet and the top 50 coming to the region, and you know, the chefs that are coming to the region and the hotels that are being built, it's phenomenal. So we don't plan too much. As long as we're happy and we're enjoying life and we have that balance of you know, family and work and you know, traveling. We love traveling as well. So no, we tend not to plan too much. Maybe we should try and plan a bit more, but we're happy in the moment. And we just see where it takes us. And you know, I'm on this journey now with our family, and we have, you know, this amazing restaurant in this amazing, you know, property in this beautiful country and city. We feel very privileged to be. We're very proud to be British, and you know, doing the you know, the British food history and you know, flying the Heston flag and dinner by Heston for Atlantis Aurora. But so no, the long-winded answer to your question is we just tend to we don't plan too much. And I, as a chef, no, I never envisioned, you know, when I went to college all those years ago and you know, made decisions and you go on, you know, you meet people and go from kitchen to kitchen. So no, I don't plan too much.
Maybe that's the trick. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it is. Yeah. We just, I think we're very happy in the moment. And that's, I think a lot of people, you can plan and plan and plan.
Yeah.
And I think it's great to have, you know, a plan and an idea, you know, idea of where you want to be, but also living in the moment, I think is really important.
Yeah. And take stock.
Yeah. Like I said earlier, we've just booked off a trip to Cape Town and you know, 3 weeks ago that wasn't even on the radar. So
yeah.
And you know, we've sat down as a family on mornings and you know, evenings, and we've researching and get my daughters to research, and I guess that's the power of the internet is and obviously chatting to different people.
And now I'm about to WhatsApp you 500 suggestions.
Getting great recommendations and meeting, you know, to cross paths with like-minded people. I love that element of you know, and you have that connection with people as well. Yeah.
Food really does.
It
the minute does. You start talking about food or travel, it just connects me to a lot of people. So
that's it. And it's a huge part of our lives. And it's a, you know, food, you know, to provoke memories from, you know, nostalgic memories, or to create, you know, we've created lots of you know, what we associate with Dubai. You know, we taste and we drink and we sit and we have experiences that now we relate to, you know, our travels of this part of our life as well. Sorry, that was a long-winded answer.
That's okay. And the last question will probably tie into a bit of it, but we ask everyone, because our podcast is called Nourish. What nourishes your soul?
Tipsy cake. Again, it probably depends on, it's like asking someone, what's your favorite food or what's your favorite country to visit?
Yeah.
I guess it depends on where I am, how I'm feeling, who I'm with. So nourishing my soul, I think meeting good people, good, genuine, honest people. And I'll always say, surround yourself with good people. You know, I think to be able to eat delicious food and travel to, you know, new and exciting countries and to experience new cultures and to learn about cultures. You know, since arriving in Dubai, I've learned so much about myself. I've changed as a person. I've learned so much about different cultures, different parts of the world. You know, lovely and genuine people, and connecting with those people as well. Whether it's, you know, we're sitting on this podcast, we've got, I think, a lot in common you know, with what we're talking about and, you know, our travels and food and drink. But also I love connecting with people when they come and sit down and we can connect with them and trigger emotion, I think is a really powerful thing to do. I had some guests in last night that they came to dinner last year and they kept in contact over Instagram and actually got them a reservation at the Fat Duck, and they've been trying to get a reservation for the last 8 years, and they were really happy and they came back and it's their anniversary. And I gave them a list this morning of my favorite things to do in Dubai and just connect with people. I love just passing on knowledge and little snippets of information. I think just connecting with people and just surround yourself with good people. I love that.
Yeah.
And tipsy cake.
Of course. Always tipsy cake. Oh, well, thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
Yeah, really great talking to you.
It's lovely to chat with you. And thank you for your time. Thank you for having us on.
Cool.
And please come back for Sunday lunch.
Oh, I will be doing so.
And come back for the lobster cucumber soup as well.
Yeah, come back for everything, basically.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so tipsy cake has been mentioned so many times on this episode, but what is it?
I think that you need to make a reservation dinner and go and try tipsy cake for yourself. So it's one of the classics.
Okay.
It's obviously, you know, based on a hugely traditional dessert. It's just warm and gooey and inviting and sugary and delicious. And yeah, you need to go try it.
Yep. No, it sounds great.
This episode was brought to you by Spinneys and is hosted by me, Tiffany Eslick, and Davina Deviccio. We're produced by Chirag Desai. Don't forget to follow Spinneys on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok for more. You can also visit us at spinneys.com, where you can shop for fresh produce and a variety of local and exclusive products.
We'll be back again in 2 weeks with a new episode. See you then.
Sorry, but like as I was talking to you about the tipsy cake, I got closer and closer and scratched my chin. so involved.
Hey.
Tiff is a little tipsy. Okay, let's just...
She's not.